Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part one of a new and very good speech by Michael Parenti. It's called Capitalism versus Reality, and it's well worth a listen. I hope you'll stay tuned. Political scientist Michael Parenti is now 82. On October 16, 2015, he was in fine form, speaking at the University of Illinois' Springfield campus. Last November, New World Notes played selections from Parenti's Q&A there. And today and next week, we'll play the speech itself. It's titled Capitalism versus Reality, and I think it's one of Parenti's best. It's about capitalism and the fight for democracy. Parenti says that democracy was not brought into being by capitalism. Far from it. Democracy was created through great struggle by the people as part of their fight to reduce their political and economic oppression and improve their lives. In fact, capitalism has fought against democracy every step of the way, and it continues to do so. So also did capitalism's predecessor forms of plutocracy. To argue these points, Parenti takes us back to the Constitutional Convention. Then he takes us back even further, to the ancient Athens of Cleisthenes and the Hoplites, then up to the recent past and the present. Here is Michael Parenti.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Pleasure to be here. I was going to talk about capitalism versus reality. And what I meant was I was going to criticize, and I am going to criticize, the dominant ideologies that hold the system upon us. The dominant orthodoxy today is that the free enterprise system, or capitalism as we know it, has given us democracy and it has given us prosperity. I want to argue that it has given us neither of those two things. In fact, democracy, both economic and political democracy, emerged not along with the growth and accumulation of wealth and capital, but in reaction to it, in resistance to it. The Constitution itself is a document born of that struggle. The founding fathers, or framers, or delegates to Philadelphia in 1787, those founders who put together and wrote the Constitution, they were rich merchants, they were bankers, landowners, and more than one-third of them were slaveholders. Who else, I ask you, who else could spend 4 months in Philadelphia from May to the middle of September 1787 writing a constitution? The dirt farmer can't do that. The servant and the household servant can't do that. The slave working in the field can't do that. He can't even leave his plantation. Who can do that? Only the rich and the well-born, as they called themselves. That's Alexander Hamilton's statement, that the country should be led by the rich and the well-born, meaning us guys. And all the other guys, us, yeah, that's right. They didn't exactly say it that way. But what you had at this convention, and if you go to Philadelphia, this convention hall is still preserved, you know, to this day, or been restored. What you had there was one individual named James Madison. And what Madison did was he kept taking notes. And at night, the other guys would go off to an inn or something. He'd go back to his room and he would transcribe the notes. So we have this remarkable document, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. I read the whole thing and went through the whole thing, in which these people, thinking they are speaking in secret, because they got the windows sealed off, the room closed in. Imagine the middle of Philadelphia summer, sealing off the rooms with all these delegates jammed in there. And they are putting together a constitution in secrecy. Madison records their remarks, and he joins in. He says, the common people are not to be trusted, and the common people are irresponsible. He moved a little bit more over to Jefferson's side on that. He loosened up a little on that in the next couple of years. But most of the people there, of course, did not change. Those who own the land should rule it. That was John Jay who said that one. So they don't pull any bones about it. They don't make any bones. They pretty much come right out and say what it is. Madison, again, in Federalist Paper number 10, which he published out to the public, the most common and durable source of faction, and by faction he didn't just mean little groups or cliques breaking up, he meant class factions, farmers against merchants, against bankers or something like that. The most common and durable source of faction is the various and unequal distribution of property. And by property, he doesn't mean land. Today, when we say property, we usually mean a couple of acres you have there in the house. Property was another word for wealth. So there were people who had wealth. Democracy, as they saw it, was dangerous, and by definition, it was excessive. Democracy was something that led to mob rule. The working poor are riffraff. The Constitution, brothers and sisters, was and is a filtered system. What does it filter? Popular sentiment, popular input, ruled by the common folks. Get a look at your Constitution. You cannot vote for the U.S. president. Nobody has ever voted for an American president. You can only vote for electors in your state. And if those electors of one party win a majority of the vote, they then cast their votes for that president. That's the way it's still working. You're not literally voting for the man. You're voting for an electoral college in your state. That was done because they wanted to filter out the passions of the people. And the people were not all crazed and impassioned and outraged about this, that, or the other thing. But they saw people who wanted to challenge us, people who said your property is too much, too fast, too dishonest, too exploitative. We won't stand for it. That's what they saw as wild mob rule and all that. Meaning people who are agitating and fighting against their interests and against the injustices that have been perpetrated on them. Senators, the Constitution that they set up, nobody could elect senators. The U.S. senators were elected by the state legislators. So again, another filter between what the people want and what was there, how it impacted on the rulers. It wasn't until 1917 with an amendment to the Constitution that we now vote directly for senators, U.S. senators. The Supreme Court, nobody has ever voted for a member of the Supreme Court. He's appointed by the president, and he serves for a lifetime. That is not democracy. That's oligarchy. That's ruled by a few who are unaccountable to anyone else. Then they got to the last part of government, which was the House of Representatives. And that's when finally a few people got up and said, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania, Colonel Mason of Virginia, that was a surprise. Mason University in Virginia, it exists, it's named after him. They got up and they said, look, we got to leave something for the people. They got to be connected to this Constitution. If we block it all out for ourselves, it's not going to get passed and be ratified. But that fight to get direct representation from the House of Representatives really brought it out in these delegates. They started coming out and talking about the people are riffraff, the people are this, and the people are mindless, and they don't know how to rule themselves, and they need our leadership, and all that sort of stuff. As it was, this Constitution was so completely undemocratic, since it was a concoction of the rich, that it wasn't getting accepted. It wasn't being ratified by the various states. To get it ratified by the states began to ratify the Constitution with a stipulation saying, we will accept this U.S. Constitution and take it on the U.S. government as long as you add rights to the people. And that's when Madison got down there and he wrote the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, which we know as what? The Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights. And that very first amendment is the people shall have the right to peaceful assemble and to have freedom of whatever they want to say in their, and their religious rights and so forth and such. Never said that we have to have religions or we institute any religion in there. Not at all. Well, enough on the Constitution. That gives you an idea that how in fact how qualified our rights were in those days. Let me say something else about the ideology of wealth and how it protects a class system. Wealth and privilege rarely stand naked. Wealth is usually enshrouded in the legitimating myths that treat this or that social order as the natural order. Chinese landlords in feudal China, William Hinton wrote about this in his book Fan Shen. He lived in China right in the middle of the Chinese Revolution too. The Chinese landlords used to have a saying that they used to tell the peasants who worked and half starved themselves so that the landlord couldn't live good and well and wastefully and whatever else. And the saying was that the sun cannot rise in the west. See, the sun, you can no more rule and run things and push me aside and try to live without me. You can no more rule than can the sun rise in the west instead of coming from the east. That's what capitalism gives us today in the ideology that is promulgated. It gives us these mythologies that it fosters democracy. And I was trying to tell you that those of wealth and property and control did not push for democracy. They talked about democracy the way many of the ancient Romans did, as a dangerous thing, a mob rule, a proletarian rabble, and so forth. And where am I? Doesn't matter. I'm getting there. Okay. Two basic things to keep in mind about democracy. First, it's not a system born of a blueprint. Rather, it emerged in imperfect fits and starts from the field of political struggle, most usually class struggle. In other words, it's not a Grecian urn that comes to us from the Greeks, from Athens, and says, this is democracy, and now we will do it, and we will use it. It's a very messy struggle thing, and it's very closely related to class struggle, from the contest between those who possess wealth and property against those who do not. This said, the second consideration becomes evident. Democracy is more than a form of governance. It also has a substantive dimension. So I make a distinction between procedural democracy and substantive democracy, or to put it more bluntly, electoral democracy and economic democracy. We hear that the free market provides for us. We should try and depend on the free market, which is one of the great gifts of capitalism, we're told. Well, we did. We've done it all through most of our history. We've depended on the free market. In 1900, I say the free market, I call it 1900. Because you look back at 1900, there were no government regulations to speak of. No minimum wage. No limit on the workday. Workers were sometimes forced to work 12 hours, 14 hours, 15, 16 hours. Kids had to work. 8, 9-year-old kids worked in factories in 1900. That was your free market at work. Unregulated, free to do what you want. No minimum wage. No occupational safety. No consumer protections. You used to eat meat that was diseased and rancid and people got sick from it. Upton Sinclair documented that in his book, The Jungle. And that was well after 1900, too. No consumer protections, no public education in most communities, no hygienic regulations, no housing safety standards. So let the free market take care of that. So that was your free market. That was the democracy. The actual struggle for democracy does not go back to Franklin or James Madison or Hamilton or those people. It goes back over 2,500 years ago, long before the Philadelphia Convention. Democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history who were seeking to defend themselves from the greed and the abuses of wealth. That's what democracy was. Time and again, it comes up as a weapon to be used against the privileges and abuses of wealth. That's what it was in Athens in the 6th century B.C., when Cleisthenes got up and ruled and had popular resistance and forces that came along with him to say, we want public control, we want public assemblies, we want to rule. The Hoplites, anybody here know who the Hoplites were? They were Athenians. They were Athenian people. They were farmers, though. And they were the guys who had enough money, I don't know how much money, whatever, they had enough property, small holders. They were small holders who could buy a shield and a broadsword and serve in the infantry, the Athenian infantry. And they put up one of the first stinks with Cleisthenes going along with it. Cleisthenes was an aristocrat. He should have been on the other side with the rich guys. He was one of these aristocrats who sided with the people and was a democrat. He believed in democracy. Cleisthenes had one of his young lieutenants, one of the best guys we're fighting, was also a member of his same family, from the same aristocratic family, and he became known as the most famous democratic leader in Greek history, and his name was Pericles. We all in grad school had to read Pericles' monumental statement to the Athenian people and all that. So the Hoplites, these small farmers, said, we want to vote. We want an assembly. We want to make decisions. If we're going to have to fight these wars, we want to be able to vote on whether we can or whether we want to and whether we don't and whether it really serves our interests and whether it doesn't. And that would lead to this remarkable thing called the popular assembly, where people just had lots. And any week, maybe 10 of you might have drawn lots, which said, you got to take two days in the assembly and listen to these cases and vote on them. And then there's rotation, you know. All of Athens that were not in servitude, that were free citizens, served. That was a system of democracy. That system, by the way, was really resented by Plato and Socrates. You know, you read Plato's dialogues, and he's got Socrates always talking about, look, a cobbler, a shoemaker, should make shoes. He could concentrate on that. That's his gift. Whereas the statesman, which would be one of his rich friends who was out there, the statesman shall rule the state. And everybody in their little spot, the laundry lady will do the laundry, and this person will do that, and all that. And in other words, people should not come out of their little roles and think that they can have a say in ruling themselves. So Socrates was not somebody, I don't adore him quite as much as some of my colleagues in political science do. And there were important issues. They fought over land holdings, wages, rents, debts, taxes, food, the fear of leveling. For Plato makes the point, Socrates makes the point too, that the people who are doing these drudgy jobs should not show up the next week in the assembly. They should just keep doing these jobs. In Sparta, they all love Sparta. In Sparta, those people are helots. They're slaves. And that's the way we want. That's the way we really want it. So the next time your political philosophy teacher tells you, you don't teach political philosophy, do you, Richard? Oh, I'm sorry. There's something I want to say about this struggle for democracy and how it's against wealth, not wealth coming along, capitalism coming along, and freeing everybody to use it, is that the pursuit of economic justice is what leads to the expansion of democratic rights. U.S. workers in the 1820s and the 1830s in America waged, state by state, male workers, this was, unfortunately, it was limited to white male workers, but it was a step in a direction to fight for the right to vote. Not because they particularly were interested in voting, but what they wanted was a better wage, a wage that they could live with. To get that wage, they had to pressure the bosses. To pressure the bosses, they had to form what were called combinations. But combinations, what today we call unions, but they were called combinations. Combinations, almost every judge in America declared them illegal and out of the way. So to get the right to a combination, you needed to start electing judges. To elect judges, you had to participate in campaigns. To participate in campaigns, you had to have the right to talk. You had to have the right to speak. You'd see organizers would come out into towns and hold leaflets up and all, and the sheriff would come and others would come and bailiffs would beat them up and throw them in jail. So the workers were actually had to fight for free speech in order to organize, in order to fight politically, in order to get these material gains of a decent wage and on, and something better, a better life, a better wage, the right to organize combinations. They had to change the law. So in the pursuit of economic democracy, challenging dominant class interests, they end up expanding political democracy. The expansion of political democracy becomes a tool, a more imperfect and inadequate tool for gains, as for instance with the New Deal and such. So with the struggle for civil rights waged by African Americans. If you read the older African American civil rights leaders, even before Martin Luther King, you know, people like William White and others, NAACP and such, they talked about segregation, of course, and Jim Crow and the terrible oppression of it, but they also were hitting bread and butter issues like jobs, housing, protection from police abuse, protection from lynch mob rule, decent living conditions, wages and such. An end of mass incarceration, as today is a blooming issue, as you know, mass incarceration, people getting arrested because a blinker on their car is broke or something, or their driver's license has expired a month ago or something. That's me, by the way. But the same with women and the right to vote and such. The right to vote among women was not merely a gender competition of, well, you men have it, so we women should have the right to vote. Women had very real injustices facing them. If a woman inherited something from her father, she gets married, her husband owns it. They couldn't own property. In one thing after another, they faced very real oppressions in work, in pay, in family, inheritance rights, education, personal safety, reproductive rights, all of which they are still fighting for. And as you can see with this new Congress here, waging war on Planned Parenthood and the like. So what we should do is notice, is observe that there's a close relationship between capitalism and democracy, an antagonistic relationship, a conflicting one. Historically, corporate capitalists have had a hard time dealing with democracy. They have opposed almost every democratic advance, the elimination of property qualifications for voting and office holding. The very super rich in America opposed eliminating that. The freedom of an independent press, they opposed that. To this day, they opposed it. The airwaves are the property of the people of the United States, yet the airwaves are licensed out to these big rich corporations and companies, Fox and CNN and such, and they're controlled by people who have a particular view and who have the money to buy and hold all that airtime. Freedom of an independent press, the right to collective bargaining. We're still fighting, breaking unions today as ever, living wage. They opposed direct elections of office holders. They are still opposing and suppressing voters' registration, making it hard to register. You go to a working guy and say, you got to go to the county office to register before you can vote. Well, the county office is 25 miles away. It's 25 miles there, 25 back. He's just worked a long day. He probably can't even get there before it closes. So he ends up not voting. And it's a way of doing what the framers were trying to do, as you see, which is suppress and make it difficult for the ordinary people, the poor people, to qualify to vote and to participate in this system. They're opposing early voting. Early voting means instead of waiting for that one Tuesday in November, which may not be a day you could even do it, your boss wants you to work 10 hours that day, you can do an early voting earlier in the week, there'll be 3 early days or something that you could pick, or a whole weekend where you can go and vote. Accessible registration. The Republican Party today is against early voting. It's for fewer polling stations. It's for briefer voting hours and periods. It's calling for 2 hurdles, a birth certificate and a picture ID, or 2 picture IDs of official documents. You know, I was just thinking, do I have 2 official picture IDs of documents? I do, because I happen to have a passport and a driver's license. Well, there's a lot of people, poor people, elderly people, who don't have driver's license, or there are a lot of people who don't have passports. They don't get an opportunity to travel abroad. To defend their unfair privileges and exploitations, the plutocracy is ruled by the wealthy. Democracy is ruled by the demos. The demos in Greek, in the early Greek language, was the people, ruled by the people. So the plutocracy here, the plutocrats sometimes must resort to force and violence, which they do. Labor battles, breaking unions, breaking demonstrations. Consider the coordinated police repression of the Occupy movement. Do you remember, any of you remember the Occupy movement of 4 or 5 years back or so? Well, it was 1% versus 99%, and the problem was the 1%, the super rich, had the police on their side, a militarized police that went out there and systematically, in 15 major cities, made war against the occupants. Now, the plutocrats themselves today claim that they are proponents of democracy. They defend democracy. They pretend to be its progenitors, not only at home but abroad. In the last half century, the leading capitalist nations have undermined and destroyed political reformist movements and revolutions in countries throughout Latin America, Central America, Africa, Central Asia, the Middle East, and just about everywhere. In Europe, too, with the destruction of Yugoslavia, which was a social democracy, which President William Clinton bombed for 78 days and nights, and also infected with depleted uranium, so that in Serbia today, cancer is, they have the highest rate of cancer in Serbia, thanks to President Bill Clinton, who was looking after us, doing all that stuff. And they resist democratization not only at home but abroad. They resist reformist governments that pursue egalitarian economic policies, as in Libya and Syria, but they support those autocrats who pursue free market policies.
Here we must pause. We are listening to part 1 of Michael Parenti's recent talk, Capitalism versus Reality. For the original recording, thanks to the University of Illinois at Springfield and to Dale Lehman of station WZRD-FM in Chicago. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Find an archive of almost all our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. It'll get to my non-carborundum, question authority, and please come back for part 2 of Parenti's talk next week. Ciao.